I think we'll begin. I'm Zev Feldman, and I can define myself as three people here. I am a scholar in musicology, ethnomusicology, working primarily on Turkish music, but also having done some work with klezmer music over the last 20 years. Second person is a musician. I play the cymbal. I was a student of Dave Taras. I worked with Andy Stapman over 25 years ago, originally reviving klezmer music at that time. Third person is I'm a simple informant. You know, I'm a second generation American. My father was from Bessarabia, and so I have a certain degree, a certain amount of information and prejudices that come from an ethnic background. So I can interview myself. This is a little problematic, because if you try to make a scientific control over your own information, and so I'm sure it's a problem with my conclusions and my methods, but you'll have to bear with me, because there are very few of us doing this research, and we all have our peculiarities. Now, if you've read the three pages that's published in the booklet, that's a summary of an article I published 3 years ago in Ethnomusicology, which was about the Bulgarish or Bulgar. And the problem that I say dealing with there is to try to classify the klezmer repertoire that we know that has survived. And let's say, I'll say before I play you any music examples, that the problem in this is that the whole, almost all of the old world of the European klezmer repertoire that we know was recorded or documented within one generation, roughly between 1910 and 1940. And in that documentation, that includes commercial recordings, mostly American commercial recordings, but of the old world repertoire that musicians born in Eastern Europe played in America and recorded in America. There's a small number of commercial recordings made in Europe. There's commercial notations published mainly for amateur musicians in America, like the Kostakovsky book published in New York. And then there's the great scientific collection of Moshe Beregovsky, which was accomplished in the Ukraine in the 1930s, of which portions have been published over the last 20 years. The bulk of it is still unpublished. And it's, I was just last month in Jerusalem, and there's a project there between the Israelis and the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences to eventually publish the remaining parts of the Beregovsky collection. That's it. I mean, that, there are a few other small collections, but there are no old notations of klezmer music. There's no old sources. There are no old manuscripts. There are no old descriptions of the repertoire of earlier periods. Now, when I work with Turkish music, I'm used to having the benefit of some old documents. I can go back, say, in my work with instrumental music, I can go back to the 17th century. I have notation, and there are some documents about repertoire. We don't have this for klezmer music. The best we have is some notations of co-territorial non-Jewish repertoire that goes back to the late 18th century in some cases, so we can make certain comparisons between what might have been Jewish and what might have been non-Jewish at a given time. So there are some things we're never going to know, but I don't give up. So I believe that we can, first of all, look at the klezmer repertoire that exists, that survived, and lump it into two very broad categories. The broad category one is the core repertoire. By core, I meant a repertoire that was known all over Eastern Europe, that was identified as Jewish, that was played by professional klezmorim for Jews, primarily for other Jews. This is actually a small part of the total repertoire that the klezmorim played, because the klezmorim had to play a lot of other things. They played a cosmopolitan repertoire of current, mostly couple dancing coming from Western Europe. That was also played for Jews, as well as non-Jews. And Jews, klezmorim in every region, played a repertoire of the local musicians, which they would play both for non-Jews and for Jews. So if you look at it numerically, the core repertoire is not the largest part of the repertoire, but it's the part that was played only for Jews, and it was the part that the klezmorim created. They didn't simply adopt from another culture, they composed it themselves. But the klezmer music is not that simple. If it were only a question of a core and then the various non-Jewish popular elements, that would be a very simple story, but it's not. There was another repertoire which then I described as a transitional repertoire or as an orientalized repertoire. Here I'm calling it a southern repertoire. And on the simplest level, those are things that have names which are usually Romanian names. The dance forms are, in Yiddish, Bulgarish, Honga, Serba, Jok, or Hora. In Romanian, Bulgariaska for Bulgarish, and then Serba is the same, Onga is Hangul in Romanian, Jok is the same, Hora is the same. The improvised non-dance form is Doina, which is the same in Yiddish and in Romanian. So you don't have to be a genius to figure out that this repertoire somehow comes from Romania. And if you look more closely, you can see that it comes from one region of Romania. It comes from the eastern part of Moldavia, almost exclusively. And because of Beragovsky's research in the Ukraine, we can tell that it entered the repertoire quite late, after the 1880s. You could trace its movement from Bessarabia, Moldavia, into Ukraine, then into Galicia, to the northwest. Now, what's particular and important about the repertoire is that it took over the American klezmer scene quite almost totally, so that for North American Jews, that's almost the only repertoire that we're aware of, that we, for people who were, say, born after 1930 or something, that's what you would know. That's what we would know, because that was developed in America, especially in New York. New York became the center of that repertoire. In fact, in other places, in Montreal and Toronto and Philadelphia and other cities in North America, you had more of the older repertoire, because this other repertoire was centered in New York and diffused mainly from New York. But when I look further into the core repertoire itself, I can see that this process of adapting things from the Jewish South in Europe to the Jewish North didn't begin in 1880. It began much earlier. How much earlier, I don't know. Possibly 100 years, possibly 200 years. But when you examine the so-called core repertoire, you can find the southern elements are embedded in the core. So there must have been this movement from south to north going back many generations before. First, I'll play you in 4 minutes of music. In these 4 minutes, I've encapsulated the whole core repertoire. This is something of an achievement, I think. To do this, I have to truncate the pieces. I'm playing four parts of four pieces. These are all part of the dance repertoire. I won't be able to deal with the non-dance. There was also a non-dance repertoire, but this is dance repertoire. This is what I call the core that Jews everywhere in Eastern Europe played and knew as Jewish music. Thank you. Now, four pieces. What do these four pieces have in common, and how do they differ from each other? Now, first of all, the first piece, all four pieces are in a minor mode, or minor key, all four. I didn't play all parts, but most of these tunes, one of the last tune modulates into a major on the fourth degree. The others stay in minor for the whole time. That's very important. Much of the core repertoire is in some sort of minor. Minor within the Jewish, Ashkenazic Jewish conception of minor, which is quite different from Western minor, but nevertheless minor. Secondly, these four tunes are two different types. The first two tunes are purely instrumental. The second two tunes also have correspond to vocal dance music, to what's called nigun. Right? So the first two, you've got, the first is a recording from the Ukraine from the 1930s, of a large ensemble. It's a Freilas von der Chuppe, has four parts originally, and it's a dance tune, you know. It doesn't correspond to any kind of vocal. The second is a share type that Naftali Brandwein played in New York in the 20s. And that tune, the second part of it is one of the archetypical share melodies. That's many share melodies have this type. And in non-Jewish folklore in Eastern Europe, this melody was often borrowed as a Jewish dance tune. I've seen it in a collection of Moldavian peasant dances, a shayer, which they got from Yiddish, share. This is one of the instrumental melodic types. Both tunes end with the same cadence, which is using two forms of the second degree, a major and a minor second. And that's typical also of the core Jewish dance repertoire. The second two have vocal versions as well. Yismachu is a well-known zimira, or nigun, when it has words. Yismachu b'malchusecha, it's a, yeah. And it's also entirely in minor. The last one it's called in Tzadik Zemrel. Dave Tyrus had recorded it. This recording is by Alicia Sviegels. It's coming out on her new CD of solo fiddle. It progresses in thirds. Right, which is typical of the Hasidic niggins, and different from the first type of dance tunes that we just heard from the first two. The first two don't do that, and also has a parallel rhythmic structure, parallel to its progression in thirds, which the first two don't have. In fact, the first tune, every part has a very complex relation of rhythm and melody. If you chart out how the rhythm works, each part has a very special pattern. And that's very typical of the instrumental part of the Jewish dance repertoire. And often the separate parts could function as separate dance tunes. So you find in different versions, you might find what is part one in one version comes out as part two or part three of another version. Sometimes a version may have two parts, sometimes it'll have three parts or four parts. The separate parts are interchangeable. In fact, and the klezmer musicians thought of them as separate units that could be recombined and developed separately. That's very characteristic of the Jewish conception of dance music. So this is part of the core. You might say this is the core of the core. Rhythmically, it's very straightforward. All the four pieces have the same straight 2-4 rhythm. There's some syncopation going on in the background, especially in the first piece. But on the whole, very, very straight, smooth kind of rhythm. Now, I'll play some examples of a quite different kind of music, of what I call the southern or transitional repertoire. And in these cases, since they're recent developments from a non-Jewish source, I'll play you the non-Jewish source right after the Jewish version. The first is first two pieces are recordings from Israel, from the old Palestinian Ashkenaz community.
Thank you.
Raise your hand if you know this tune, please. Uh-huh. Okay, this in America was one of the most widespread klezmer tunes for a long time. It's also very well known in Israel from the old Palestinian Yishuv. This is the source. Who recognizes the language? Romanian. This is Fanin Caluca, who's a very famous gypsy fiddler from Oltenia, from southwest Romania. It's a famous gypsy song. It's popular in the early part of the century. Next example I have is also from the Meron Hasidim, the Meron Festival in Israel. Second tune is called Junatate Joc. It was recorded in the 1960s in Bacău, which is a town in southwestern Moldavia. It must have gone to Palestine some point earlier in this century. Third example is by Dave Taras. It's one of his first recordings, the tune he recorded after his doina in the 1920s. Thank you. Now, the last recording was something of a surprise to me. I only came across it last year. It's a recording done by Bob Cohen, who an anthropologist who lives now in Budapest. He recorded this in southwestern Moldavia about 2 or 3 years ago from a gypsy fiddler and kobza player, who also played this tune after the Doina. So this must have been the pattern. It's a sirba. It's the rhythm you hear is quite different. It's Dave plays it, Dave Tarras plays it. And when I studied this tune with him, actually, and he would tell me specifically to phrase it this way and not to phrase it as a sirba. He didn't like that phrasing. He liked this phrasing, but he actually never explained that the tune was originally a non-Jewish Moldavian tune. Which brings me to the Bulgar, Bulgariaska. I'll play you the earliest recorded Jewish Bulgar, and then a recording from Moldavia of the a similar genre. Here, the second tune is not simply the prototype of the Jewish tune. The Shulam's Bulgarish, played by the accordion player Yankovitz, is probably an original Jewish tune. It has the name of Shulam, meaning there was a klezmer named Shulam who composed this tune. So it was Jewish, it was a klezmer composition. But the dance and the pattern is from the Bulgariaska, which is one of the dominant dances of Moldavia. What happened, though, and this I explain at length in my article on Bulgariaska, was the klezmorim took this type of dance and type of rhythmic patterns, and they went with it. They created dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of tunes, which were quite far, after a while, from the Moldavian prototype, and they were played far from Moldavia, in Ukraine and Galicia and so forth. And the fullest development of the type took place in New York. If any of you were at the Epstein Brothers concert last night, most of the Jewish pieces that they played that were not theater tunes were Bulgars. And by the 1960s, for the American klezmorim, especially the New York klezmorim, the whole repertoire was called the Bulgars, because the Bulgar had dominated. The older repertoire was quite peripheral by this time. Things like the Cher and the Freilachs became a very small part of the repertoire. Very few people composed new Shers and Freilachs. They kept the old ones, especially in New York. There was very little work with the older forms. They developed the Bulgar, especially. Now, back in Europe, it didn't happen that way. In Europe, the Bulgar was not so developed. It was still largely a Moldavian form. And in Moldavia itself, the Jews kept, the klezmorim kept the old Jewish repertoire. I was kind of surprised to learn there was, when I looked at what was documented in Moldavia, even as late as the 1970s, there was a recording of Avram Bugich, who was the last great klezmer fiddler in the Yash in Moldavia. It's a short recording done at home of Jewish repertoire. There was one short bulgar, a very old Jewish bulgar, and the rest was entirely Jewish, entirely core klezmer repertoire. So he, living in Moldavia, was quite able to distinguish what was a Moldavian repertoire and what was a Jewish repertoire. Whereas in New York, the American-born klezmorim pretty much had lumped the whole thing into this transitional southern repertoire, and that became the Jewish repertoire for people here. Now, to complicate matters further, what I just said would make you think that there was these two separate items, the Jewish repertoire and the Moldavian repertoire and the other. Of course, it wasn't that simple either. And in my little article in the booklet here, there's a couple of sentences that suggest why it wasn't so neat. The reason, of course, is that when the Jews came in large numbers to Moldavia in the later 18th, early 19th century, they were entering Turkish Moldavia, Ottoman Moldavia. There, the gypsies already had large organized music, big ensembles. They had their own musicians' guilds. The Jews entered those guilds. The documents we have from Moldavia talk about Jewish musicians along with gypsies, Romanians, Greeks, Armenians, Russians who were playing music professionally. Whereas in the rest of Eastern Europe, Jews had their own separate guilds. The klezmers were, they might be here and there a non-Jew playing in a Jewish band, but the control was completely in the hands of the Jewish professionals. In Moldavia, it was a different story. It was an ethnically mixed bands. So this existed at least since the later 18th century, early 19th century. So by the time of our klezmer repertoire, we have over 100 years, maybe 150 years, of a development of a mixed repertoire where the bands essentially were mixed, mostly Jews and Gypsies, the two predominant groups. So you really have to think of three repertoires being played there. One repertoire was entirely for Romanians, for Moldavians. Another repertoire entirely for Jews, you know, a core Jewish repertoire. There was a third repertoire that was mediating in between, right? And it had elements of both the Jewish repertoire and the Moldavian repertoire and many other things. It was heavily influenced by Greek music, because as I indicated there, the Greeks were a dominant element in the Romanians, in Moldavian cities until the middle of the 19th century. So there was a heavy, strong, direct influence of Greeks from the Balkans and Greeks from Istanbul into this middle music, this between the Jewish music and the Moldavian music. And I'll give you an example or two of that. One of them is a tune that's played here quite a lot now. It's called Romanish Blagara. It was recorded in the Ukraine in the 30s. You probably heard the tune. By now you've probably noticed that most of the tunes you've heard in the second section are all using either augmented second scales or using the minor with the raised fourth, which is also a kind of augmented second with the tonic one whole note down. This is also no accident because this is typical of this southern Moldavian, Moldavianized or southern repertoire. It's rarely in minor. It's only one tune in this collection is using minor at all. The others are using this kind of augmented second or this variant of the minor, the raised fourth. This of course is very important. This choice of scale is very important because this peculiar kind of minor with raised fourth doesn't correspond to anything important in Jewish liturgical music at all. There is a prayer called Misha Berach, which may use this mode or this scale, but it's, on a whole, a very unimportant part of Ashkenazic music. Whereas minor is crucial. Minor is absolutely critical. So that, in a sense, this music, because of its choice of scale, separates it from anything in the Jewish religious repertoire. And so Jews hearing this could not really associate this with anything in the liturgy, which is also very significant, because in the core repertoire, you've got many melody types which relate very, very closely to religious singing. So that much of the core repertoire, even though it's secular in a sense, it has suggestions and associations that are religious. This repertoire has none of those associations. It's completely secular from the word go. Secondly, it's completely instrumental, except for that first song that the Romanian gypsy singer was singing. All of these are coming from instrumental music. This is also very important. In Jewish culture, you have this interplay between instrumental music and vocal music. In Romanian culture, the gypsies had developed a very strong instrumental tradition that was independent of vocal music. So this was very important. When you played this repertoire, it was secular on two counts. One, because of its use of mode and scale. Secondly, because of its use of instruments and instrumentally based melodies. Now, the last example I'll play you was recorded about 25 years ago by Stu Rotman when he was visiting the Iași region of Moldavia. I'm told now by Bob Cohen that this kind of playing is virtually extinct. And it's much to be lamented, because this represented exactly this kind of mixed style that was dead in the center between Moldavian music and Jewish music. Stuart didn't interview the musicians then. I don't know if any of them are Jewish. Probably not. They're probably gypsies. But again, listen to the style of playing. Okay, as you can, I think you can hear, both the trumpet and the clarinet are using the typical tonal timbre of Jewish clarinet and Jewish trumpet playing. The ornamentation also is typically klezmer. It doesn't relate to any other kind of Romanian playing, whether on clarinet or on taragot or any other horn or reed instrument. The phrasing of the rhythm is something that we'd associate with klezmer music more than with Romanian music. Yet this was not a Jewish wedding. This was a repertoire being played for non-Jews there. And this repertoire had developed over a period of over 100 years. And it occupied this central mediating position between the Jewish societies and the various non-Jewish societies of Moldavia. Now, as such, it became very attractive, not only for the Jews living there, but for the Jews everywhere in Eastern Europe. This repertoire was in demand. It was transmitted before the days of cassettes and radios. It was transmitted orally by musicians at second and third and fourth hand. You know, Moldavian musicians transmitting this to musicians over the border in the Ukraine and further north. I know this from interviews with Dave Taras. He wasn't a Moldavian. He was from the next region over in the Ukraine. And for them, for the people of his region, this music had great value. This had actually higher status. First of all, higher status than the local non-Jewish music, which the Jewish musicians didn't like to play, and which had very little status in the Jewish community, and also higher status than the old Jewish music. You see, and Taras was very explicit about this, that he valued this music more than the older Jewish music. Now, we don't have to agree with that point of view, but you can see why the musical elements in this gave more variety and also freed the Jewish audiences from the associations with the Jewish religion. And this is a very important point. I think it's the last point I'll make, since I have to make this brief, that what's most difficult for us to understand here in North America, and also difficult for the people in Israel to understand, is the relation between the religious culture and the non-religious culture for East European Jews. It's a very difficult question. And the relationship between the two elements, first of all, was not the same in every part of Eastern Europe. It also changed diachronically. There's very much of a change in time in the relation of religion and what we would call secular thinking. And these things mean different things in Israel, and they mean different things in the US and Canada. So if we try to understand what did it mean for Ukrainian Jews of the early 20th or late 19th century to say they were listening to secular dance music, yet they chose a specific kind of secular dance music that would mark them off as Jews. It would not be the same as the local dance music. Why would they do this? And this is a question that's hard for us to understand. The simple answer would be, of course, that Jews from there would have the core repertoire, which they only played for Jews, which had been developed by Jews for many generations, and that would be Jewish dance. So you had a religious element relating to Nigun on one side, and you had a secular element relating to the Freilachs and Scher on the other, and you would think that the Jewish musical culture would be happy with that kind of solution. That would be sufficient. But that was not the reality. The reality was that there was yet another element of non-Jewish, say, of quasi-Jewish, partly Jewish dance, which had been developed historically only in one region, in Moldavia. And this partly Jewish and partly Gypsy, partly Greek, partly Moldavian music had a certain status and was used to, say, to develop and certain emotions that could not be developed either by the core Jewish repertoire or by the local Ukrainian non-Jewish repertoire, which had yet a different association for a Jewish audience. Right? So this is really the key to understand how klezmer music developed, for us to try to fathom the mentality of the East European Jews in balancing the several repertoires, all of which had to be in the functioning repertoire of a practicing klezmer. A professional, an amateur, of course, could choose to concentrate on one element, which they did. You had amateurs who played mainly Hasidic Nigunim, amateurs who played mainly Russian songs or Yiddish folk songs, But a professional couldn't specialize that way. A professional had to know the whole repertoire, and that was a whole functioning orbit. That's why in the article I have this image of a planet with satellites or whatever, because the whole thing was in action, in interaction with each other. And of course, when this functioning, orbiting, fluid system was transplanted from its original environment, either into Palestine or into North America, that same fluidity could no longer exist. In a sense, those balls that were going in the air had to come down on one side or the other. In a sense, you can see how both the Palestinian Jewish and the North American Jewish communities had to decide for themselves what they wanted to hear, what was Jewish, what was non-Jewish, what was religious, what was non-religious. And let's say our conceptions of these things became further and further from the conceptions of the people who'd lived where the music had been created. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.